Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, we are nearing the completion of our tribute to Charles Krauthammer series. Now, it's been a fascinating series for me and my guests, and I hope all of you listeners out there as well. There is something that even more special happened during this series. On February 17th, 2020, JBL aired its 200th episode. That's amazing. That means we've been at this for 4 years. And so that's really exciting. Now, I shared that feat with special guest Jeremiah Jocks as we discussed Charles Krauthammer's essay, Annals of Art. And I have to admit, that was a fun program. For today's podcast, I thought it might be interesting to go back and listen to some excerpts from the previous 199 podcasts. Now, of course, we can't give you all the clips from those episodes, but I will give you a good smattering of what we accomplished. And it really is amazing. I had never done anything like this before in my life. Here I am, one of those guys that would probably like to retire, and I got challenged with doing a podcast. So I got up and running, and really it was pretty exciting. So please enjoy this special 50-minute or so special broadcast. In the first 100 episodes, I concentrated mostly on classic and current literature. I discussed highlights from these first 100 programs in a one-hour special, which happened to be the 100th program. So I guess that shouldn't be so funny, but it is. Anyway, I'd like to give you a few snippets from that program. Now, in this first clip that I'm going to play for you, I explained who I was and my qualifications for doing a podcast on literature. And I have to admit, when I listened to this, I really chuckled. So here we go. Hey, welcome to our first program here on KPCG.FM. Before we get into today's program, I thought I'd just tell you a little bit about myself. Certainly you want to know who I am and why you should listen to me. Well, I have a bachelor's degree in English literature and a master's degree in library and information science. Now, what does all that mean? Well, as an undergraduate, I focused my studies in 18th and 19th century English poetry, and I also studied 20th century American authors. Also, as part of my undergraduate degree, I concentrated on poetry writing. Now, for my master's degree, I concentrated on resources and bibliography, which is kind of just a fancy name for becoming a reference librarian. I was trained to do research for, let's say, the geology department, or trained to do research for the chemistry department. I mean, I was trained to be like the book hound that went and hunted things down for people. But during my career of 40 years, and really it just seems like yesterday to me, I've been an assistant director for a 9-branch county library system in the Pacific Northwest. I worked for a Westinghouse Electric Corporation for 14 years. I worked in their information services department. It was in that department I served as a technical writer. I was also a technical librarian. I was the assistant director of the corporation's technical communications committee. I really had the opportunity to travel all over the United States with that job. And then I was also a ghostwriter for company executives, and that means some of their presidents. Hey, but what am I doing right now? Well, I'm senior writer and editor for the Philadelphia Trumpet magazine, also the Royal Vision magazine, and both of these magazines are produced by the Philadelphia Church of God. You could read my articles if you'd like on thetrumpet.com or at thetrumpet.com and also at pcog.org. I also teach English language literature and Shakespeare here at Herbert W. Armstrong College. And most important of all, I'm Irish, which gives me the gift of gab. Now, in the second clip, I gave the goals and purposes for JBL with really some pretty scary intensity. I don't know what I had eaten that morning, but it must have been really powerful. Here we go.
I would like you to consider this program
as, well, the biggest international book club you could ever become a part of. But here's the real benefit. There's no membership fee for you. However, I am going to ask you to buy some books. I'm also going to ask you to read some books, because on this program, we're going to talk books. We're going to talk classic fiction. We're going to talk current fiction. We're going to talk current books on social issues. We're going to talk essays. We're going to talk magazine articles. We're going to talk about books on history. We're going to talk about biographies. And we're also going to talk about my favorite, poetry. Now, having got my feet wet after a few months, I took the bold and audacious opportunity to take JBL internationally. Now, with the help of Mr. Richard Palmer, who I'm sure all of you listen to on the Trumpet Daily, I was able to pitch the Royal Shakespeare Company in Stratford upon Avon, and of course that's in the English Midlands, and I asked them to allow me to interview two young actors that were starring in their production of Hamlet. Now, at that same time, I was teaching Hamlet here at the college. So to my shock and surprise, they actually allowed me to come into their administration building, and I was able to tape a 30-minute program. Here's the very first clip of me doing an interview on JBL. So I hope you really enjoy this, and don't laugh.
Last night, I want to be able to tell you that I was able to attend the RSC performance of Shakespeare's Hamlet, and two actors from the performance have graciously agreed to be here. They're taking time out of their busy rehearsal schedule. They have another performance tonight, and I'll just tell you now, I'm going back tonight. So anyway, they are here to talk to us about Hamlet. With me today is Papa Esadu. He has the title role of Hamlet. And I also have with me Miss Hamlet. That's being 64 and jet lagged. But I have Natalie Simpson with me, and she has the title role of Ophelia. So welcome to The Best Literature. Melanie Phillips had a great article in the Times, May 10th of is it still May? It is still May, yes. And she gave really high praise to the Royal Shakespeare Company because, first of all, the Royal Shakespeare Company has a high value on education and educating people about Shakespeare. Here's one of the quotes that she said, and I don't want to get into, you know, any politics here, but she does say about Shakespeare, she says, "Shakespeare doesn't need cuts or additions or transgendered trapeze artists gyrating in hot pants to David Bowie. Ooh. In Shakespeare's plays, the words are everything." And I have to agree with Ms. Phillips, and that's what I really try very hard to work with and with my students is to teach them. That's everything. I mean, it's the poetry. Mm-hmm. It's the poetry that you want. And, of course, I just want to tell you last night that, you know, I've kind of hooked on the Branagh film because we use it a lot. You know, I do make the students read in class. They have to read on their own. I mean, we're talking 19, 20-year-olds. I really try and stress with them, look, it's the poetry you want to get into. Mm-hmm. It's the understanding that Shakespeare is trying to communicate. And I have to say, I was really moved to tears last night with your performance, both of you. And it was the words. I mean, Papa, you were so clear, and the diction was so clear, and it was really easy to follow it. And, you know, some of the actors will go so fast, and I know there's got to be pressure on you guys. Mm-hmm. I mean, so the thing that I'd like to do is just, you know, let's talk about the poetry, and let's talk about how it's impacted you. I mean, doing Hamlet, that's got to be, like, the role that any Shakespearean actor would want. And you have it, yeah. And you're just you're commanding it. And of course, I did some research before I came over. But so they don't want to hear me; they want to hear how is doing Hamlet and all the poetry impacted your life?
Playing Hamlet is it kind of feels like being in a 12-round bout with Mike Tyson. 6 times a week, you know,
I can't believe that.
You come out the other end and you feel kind of like you've been knocked from pillar to post. And it's difficult. And it requires a lot of kind of physical, vocal, mental, emotional, psychological preparation to be able to do it. You can't just jump into it. For example, we started off doing a 5-week run of this play. And then we... I fortunately had a month off whilst half the cast rehearsed another play, Cymbeline. And then I had to come back into it after being away from it for a month. And I was like, hey, man, I've done it for 5 weeks. It's all in my body, it's in my mind. I walked on and there was nothing. Nothing. It was kind of like trying to walk on your hands. So, yeah, it's really difficult and it really requires huge preparation. But the language, as you quite pertinently pointed out, is the key to it. I mean, I think like Shakespeare is a genius when it comes to linguistic skill, but I think Hamlet is kind of like his piece de resistance in that sense.
I really, you know, when I look at Hamlet, of course, I was a lit major all the way back in the 70s, so I remember sitting in lit class, and of course, we had to pass a 4-credit Shakespeare class before they'd give us our degree, you know, so it was not easy. But I remember sitting in class going through these plays saying, what are they talking about? You know, of course, now that I've had some life experience and all that, I understand it better. But what's it like doing the soliloquies? I mean, they're so instructive. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think about it or... do you think about it before you get up there? I mean, you have to understand it to be able to portray what you portrayed last night.
Fully. Like, I try not to think about it before I do it because that takes away from the immediacy of the connection to the language of what you're saying and the connection with your audience. Because, I mean, like, soliloquies are essentially just conversations with audience members.
Oh, that's...
That's what I feel.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
Like, if there's a question in the soliloquy, you're asking it without knowing that there's going to be an answer. So I could ask, am I a coward, for example? And I'd hope that someone would tell me either I am or I'm not. But if not, then that pushes me on to the next question. Who calls me villain? So, I mean, like, I think that kind of helps it. But, I mean, these soliloquies are just mad because they're so well-known in terms of English literature or English language literature. It's kind of like the kind of greatest hits.
But, you know, it's something... I don't know if you'd agree with me. You've done certainly a lot more. But don't you feel sometimes that Shakespeare is actually Hamlet? That he's writing for himself?
I don't know.
That's what I do to my students. This is what I do to them.
I remember someone wrote that Hamlet is a play written by a genius about a genius. So if that's, I mean, it's obviously a very personal play because his son was called Hamlet. His son
that's
called Hamlet. And this is a play about a son avenging a father's death. So there's a kind of like mirror image kind of thing in there.
So the thing is, one of my favorites, it's not really necessarily a soliloquy, but when he's talking with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, you know, after they, you know, of course, Claudius is trying to cover his neck and, you know, brings them there because he wants to find out what's really going on in Hamlet's mind. It's all a big ruse. But then he goes in, he breaks into what a piece of work is man, you know, how long. So he, it's like, can you imagine Shakespeare writing this? It's like, I kind of imagine this is what he's wondering. You know, here we are. Here we have human beings. You know, and he brings us out in other soliloquies. We have this great discourse. We have these minds. We can reason. And yet we can get into such terrible messes sometimes. Mm-hmm. And it's like, here's Hamlet. He was a brilliant. I mean, according to the story, of course, you know, it's based on history anyway, but... here he's at Wittenberg, he was studying philosophy. He was a very, very well-educated man, probably more ready to take over the throne than certainly Claudius was. And he certainly knew Claudius was a ditz compared to his own dad. So it's. I mean, it took a lot of genius to put so much detail in the story. And then let's just transfer to Natty a little bit, because you get enough on stage. So how do you feel playing Ophelia? I mean, it's probably one of the most dramatic female roles that you could play.
I think playing Ophelia has had more of an emotional effect on me than I maybe anticipated. When I first started doing some research into the character, Simon and I, decided to get some women from this charity called Mind, and they basically support women with manic depression, bipolar, psychoses. And we spoke to them about what we thought Ophelia was going through, actually, not just madness, but something that's tangible. And we looked at kind of her symptoms, what she was saying, what she was doing, how she was acting. We decided on manic depression with some episodes of like psychoses, like she's having a bit of a psychotic break. And I think through talking, I mean, I spoke to them for hours and kept in touch with them by email afterwards. And I did a lot of research myself online, watched a few documentaries. And that, I think, coupled with having kind of experiences with people in my life that have mental issues, I think it really opened something in me, especially to have to go into a place where I do at the end in that madness scene. It's kind of recognizing some things in yourself where you're like, wow, I think everyone has, under extreme stress, everyone has the capacity to break a little bit. Everyone does. And I think that's what kind of shook me a little bit.
I thought you did a great job. I mean, the one thing is, like I said, I felt like you were real. I mean, it was like I said, you see a film, they're kind of flat. I mean, even I don't care how much color you have, I don't care how much, you know. But when you're actually in the theater, and we're really pretty close, I mean, we're really pretty, even though we might be sitting in the upper level, we're still pretty close to you. And you really were able to communicate the feeling of this poor girl. You do feel for her. And even like with the queen, she doesn't want to see her. And I'm thinking, well, why don't you want to see her? She needs help. So I thought you did a great job of that. And but it really showed the stages. Both of you showed the stages of what these characters go through. You know, Hamlet, he thinks he's, you know, calls himself a lily-livered pigeon. And he's grappling with this, you know, he's grappling with, is the ghost, is he a demon, you know, or is this really a spirit that could help me? You know, he doesn't come to those conclusions right away, but we find him transferring. And then here you see this Ophelia in love with her father, you know, in love with, obviously in love with Hamlet. Obviously there, you know, she's ready to just begin her life. And then this tragedy happened. Her father's killed. You know, the love of her life tells her, I never did love you, which is a lie. And what really got to me the most is here, you know, Laertes is putting the facsimile of you in the grave. And then Hamlet finally admits, I loved her, and yet you never heard it. And so I thought it was just a great, great, I don't know, it really communicated it to me. And I thought, have you ever thought about, have you learned anything from Ophelia that you could transfer to maybe people that you know have depression? Have you learned something? I mean, it's really...
Yeah, I would say it's interesting to note that when people... Because with Ophelia, what I realize is that she cracks because she feels immense guilt. She feels that because she listened to her dad and she decided to end things with him, Hamlet went crazy. He then turned on her, became violent with her, abusive. You know, they became abusive. He then goes and kills her father. So she thinks, okay, so my father's death is on me. His treatment is on me. So I think it's interesting to note, to think, or to realize that sometimes when you get to this state where you're so broken, it's all about blaming things on yourself. And sometimes it's good to get an understanding of the whole picture and to not sit there and blame yourself and take everything on yourself, because that's when you kind of implode.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, I just thought it was a great portrayal, and you know, she's a great character.
One of the most enjoyable interviews from the early days of JBL was with Music for Life host Ryan Malone. Now, using the background of Thad Carhart's memoir, The Piano Shop on the Left Bank, we discussed how the piano was chosen for the prestigious Armstrong Auditorium. And I have to say, this program, I learned more about what was going on at Armstrong than I had ever done before. So here we go with this one. Well, welcome, Ryan.
Thanks so much for having me.
One thing I also want to say is Ryan is also our concert manager for our Armstrong Foundation Performing Arts Series. And it's really a great series. He is an accomplished pianist. He has performed on our exquisite Armstrong Auditorium stage. And one thing that most people may not know about Ryan he is the man with his one of his assistants, Mark Jenkins. He had the incredible opportunity of going to Germany and picking out one of our two Steinway pianos that we feature on our stage. And if you've been reading this book, you know that Carhartt talks a lot about choosing a piano, or does a piano choose you? And so I'd like to start out, Ryan, if you don't mind. Let's talk a little bit about that. What was it like to go to Germany and pick out a Steinway? I can't imagine anything greater for a pianist.
Oh, it was fantastic. Of course, traveling in its own right, but then going to the Steinway factory, getting the grand tour before you go into the piano selection room. They show you around. They let you take pictures. There's one room they say no cameras in here. It has some of their patented things they do. And then we get into the piano room. We had six Model D concert grands. Model D is the 9-foot. We had six of them all in a row, and there were probably about five or six times as many pianos in that room, but we only looked at those first six. Those were the only ones of that size. And so those were all the same brand. Those were all the same size, but yet they were all different. And I really did relate to what Carhartt talks about in his book. Now, he was looking at all sorts of different nationalities of pianos and even brands and things like that. And even, will it be this size or that size? So we had it narrowed down. But even then, each piano was completely unique.
So did the studio look like Luke's atelier?
No, it wasn't all everything. This was a showroom, more like, if you would imagine a showroom where pianos were just, they were more lined up in, say, three columns of pianos. And it, right as you walked in, closest to the door, the first column on the left had the six 9-foot Steinways. And so those were the ones we were housed at for the next, you know, half a day, just picking them.
So how long did it take you to decide this is the piano? You know, Carhartt spends a lot of time on how to pick pianos. So.
Right. Well, now, we were in a little different situation where we had, the piano was basically purchased. We just had to pick the one. And that's pretty common for concert halls to have someone go representing the hall, knowing what the hall is like and what the needs of the program are, so that they can pick the perfect piano for the program. But I felt like we picked a perfect piano, as perfect as a piano can be, not just for our hall, but it took a few hours, well, a couple hours even, just to land on the one. You know, Mark and I both were secretly making notes about the six pianos, not sharing with each other. And he's got a great poker face, and I didn't know which one he was leaning toward. Maybe he knew which one I was leaning toward, but I got to the one we picked last, and he had started on that one, so we kind of were going in opposite directions. So when I got to that one, I think he saw me perk up, and he had his notebook, and he said, "Yeah, this is the one that I've been." Basically, it was like we said, 1, 2, 3, pick the one, point to the one you like, and we pointed to the same one. So, which was really amazing. It took a couple hours, and then we spent a couple hours just playing the snot out of it. You know, we just had to like try everything. We came prepared with all sorts of repertoire. That was even going over there. We practiced a lot on music, because we were trying to come with a variety of repertoire. So then we really played that one piano and made sure then, after we both knew the preference, that this was in fact the one, that it was consistent all the way up and down.
So I'm assuming that when you went over there, you know what kind of concerts we've already had here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can name a few for people.
So,
you know, the famous pianists we've had here.
Right, so. Yeah, we had Andre Watts here. We've got the Eroica Trio coming up in a few weeks, and, you know, that features the piano very heavily.
Yes.
And so this was actually even before Armstrong Auditorium opened, but we had the series. And so we had the series in another building on campus, and we were going to use that. We weren't going to have that piano until the building opened.
The building opened, right.
But we were selecting it with the vision in mind.
Because I know when Andre Watts came, I mean, there's some really great things in the book where, you know, they compare the clavichord and the harpsichord to the piano, and how when the piano was first invented, it was like the boilermaker of the harpsichord. You know, it was seen as an instrument you could bang on.
Right.
But when Andre Watts came, that's exactly what he did to the piano.
Right.
I mean, he did bang on it, but the music that came out was astounding.
Right.
So did you actually go
there with the idea that you would have like really loud music and then really soft music, and so
right. Well, it's funny because they even said there are some Russian pianists who they all want it to be loud. They want the piano to just be loud, and they said they're looking for the piano that's a trumpet, you know. And they were salesmen, so they made us feel really good about what we were selecting. But they said, well, you know, you guys are looking not just for loudness, but you're looking for that whisper as well. And the piano we found had that variety, so it could. It could, like Carhartt says, you know, the world gets louder as soon as the piano comes on the scene. But then it also could just get down in that hush. That Armstrong Auditorium has that crisp acoustic for, you know, just a small recital hall. And so you can have the roar and you can have the whisper, and it's all in the same. Even like what he said in the book, he used that metaphor of like from thunder to whisper. You know, that's the kind of range that this piano has.
Yes. Well, it is amazing. One of the things that I just wanted to bring out in terms of Steinway, the thing that Carhartt brings out, and you can correct me if I've read this wrong, but I was really surprised that one of the biggest centers to make Steinway was actually the United States years ago. I mean, I always thought you had to go to like Germany to find the Steinway.
Right.
But
they were an American family. They were of German heritage, but they were an American family that started that company. And then when they opened the German factory, there's things that the Germans do, like Lucan here says, I consider Hamburg Steinway as a German piano, because the Germans have perfected that particular craft in a special way, in different ways than the New York pianos. So it was American in its origination, but yet, you know, it's morphed, you know, with the German accent there.
Yeah, could you talk a little bit about, you know, he talks about the uniqueness of pianos, and again, I love my piano music, and I have my favorites, and, you know, when I'm reading or writing or studying, I always have classical music going on in my earbuds, you know, so mm-hmm. that just seems like it relaxes my brain that I can actually think. So I know Carhartt brings some things out in the book. Could you like, you know, maybe talk a little bit about how these nationalities make these individual pianos?
Well, he does talk about that early on in the book, pages 18 and 19. He's talking about the French prefer anything French, and he talks about even a Ukrainian piano and a Russian piano and the German pianos and that type of thing, and just the different. Priorities that those makers put on. It can get pretty technical, but I think he gives a really nice overview of just how you're dealing with so many different parts. You know, like he says, in one sense, it's a pretty simple concept: press, key, hear sound. But then he says, but the particulars, you know, the particulars become quite complicated. And so, you know, like even in a Steinway, when you're dealing with 12,000 pieces of wood, you're talking about trees from all over that have all sorts of different lifespans. And so even in those six Steinways that were supposedly identical, they're all handmade. And so, you know, the guy doing this part and the guy doing that part, they're two different people. They could have two different days when they're making two different pianos, and it could be slightly different. And so even the uniqueness of one piano is astounding. But then, yeah, you get into the nationalities, and it's even more diverse.
So do you think like that when you pick a piano, is it just more subjective? I mean, to the person that's going to own it, or is it like you had to really? It's kind of like you had to pick a piano that would be interesting for all the audiences that are coming,
and all the repertoire that'd be performed, and all the different kinds of ways the piano would be approached, and so we had to find really the catch all. Piano. It chooses you. You know, when you.
That's what I wanted to ask you. Did it choose?
Yes.
You? Did the Steinway choose you?
because of what we were looking for. Because we needed something with so much range. You know, in that sense. So it really did. It stood out in that way. Now, someone like he said, well, you know, a Russian pianist might pick this piano because wow, it's just got a really really. It's got a brassier sound, and it can really cut through the orchestra when you play those opening chords of the Tchaikovsky First Piano Concerto or something like that. So someone might be looking for something in a smaller hall or a bigger hall, or it's almost always going to be played with an orchestra, or it'll never be played with an orchestra. Those considerations, certain things about the piano jump out at you and let you know that this is the one for you.
Now remember, you can go back and listen to all of these programs in detail, and you can go back and listen to really almost the last 200, and you can do that at kpcg.fm. During the second 100 programs, I want you to realize that I wanted to move mostly into autobiographies, biographies, and memoirs, and I kind of get into more of a serious nature to help readers better understand the world today and the way it is. And of course, with all this coronavirus going on out there, you know the world is very different today than it was even 4 years ago. This first clip I'm going to play for you is my take on why you should read autobiographies, biographies, and memoirs. So here we go. Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, you know, it is hard to believe that the month of April is nearly over. Now, I think we all know what's going to be happening in the education world. College and high schools will soon be conducting graduation ceremonies. All of the elementary and middle school students will be out of school for summer vacation. And parents and grandparents, here's a question to think about. Should we allow our school-age children to just waste away summer's time? Now, most expert educators realize that education should not just come to a sudden halt because school is out. The facts are in. Students who do nothing to stimulate or educate their minds during the summer months lose. I mean, they don't gain. They lose a large portion of what they gained in the school year the previous year. Now, that should cause all parents and even grandparents alarm. But I want to ask you parents and grandparents a question. What about you? Shouldn't you spend some summertime continuing your own education as well? Now, I'm sure you probably all figure out where I'm going with this. Well, here I go. Summer is the perfect time for reading. And parents and grandparents, you should be reading. And if you do your reading, well, you're setting a great example for, well, the young people that are close to you in your life. I know some parents, or I should say some grandparents, are even raising young children. And, of course, parents, we hope you're raising young children if you have young children. But I want to encourage you to read one particular genre of book this summer. And the title of the genre is biography. Now, for today's program, what I want to explain is why you and your children should be reading autobiographies, biographies, and memoirs. Now, the series that on biographies, I did begin with a small biography, and it was Paul Johnson's popular biography of Winston Churchill, and it was actually titled Churchill. So I think I actually developed a unique way of introducing this book. So here is clip 7, and really enjoy this. Happy Winston Churchill Day to all of you listeners out there. Now, I'm sure you're probably as surprised by that as I am. I did not know that April 9th has been set aside as Winston Churchill Day. And I'm sure you didn't know it. And I'm sure your community is not holding big celebrations about Winston Churchill. I know here we are in Edmond, Oklahoma, and there's no big celebration. There's nothing in the paper. Let's celebrate Winston Churchill today. But I thought what I'd do for today's program, since it is Winston Churchill Day, I thought that I would give you some interesting facts about Mr. Churchill that you may not know or recognize unless you think about him. Now, the book we're reading, or you should be reading right now, is Paul Johnson's biography titled Churchill. Now remember, this is a biography that's considered popular biography. It's definitely not a definitive biography. And so some of these facts that we're going to discuss are not in this book. Some of these facts are in his book, and we're going to be talking more about them as we go through the series. But it is interesting that I know the circle of friends that I spend a lot of my time with consider Sir Winston Churchill, Western civilization's most beloved political figure. Now, even more, I know that here at Herbert W. Armstrong College and, here at the Philadelphia Church of God, we know that he was a great leader and a protector of freedom. In fact, he really did save Western civilization from the Nazi curse. Now, in our final program on the Churchill series, we'll talk about this more. Now, I think Mr. Churchill is pretty well known for his stubborn resistance to Hitler during the darkest hours of the Second World War. Now, I have seen the most recent movie titled Darkest Hour about Winston Churchill, and I don't think it does an adequate job of showing the reality of his stubbornness. There's one part in the movie where it looks like he's weakening and he's going to consider negotiating with Hitler. That never happened in history. And he never considered entering a peace negotiations with that crazy, you know, madman. He never did consider it.
Now, also during this series, my wife Deborah and I also discussed the life of George and Martha Washington. And we focused on how they helped the troops at Valley Forge. This was really an interesting program for me and something I never even considered would have happened. So really enjoy this clip. If you look at the Revolutionary War, it was a long war. It was 8 years. We also know from history that George Washington lost many battles, but yet he won the war, and that was really important. Now, Patricia Brady's book, we mentioned this last, several programs ago, and it's titled Martha Washington and American Life. I really highly recommend the book. I think it's great reading for you. It's really not that expensive. But the point is, you know, Valley Forge, you know, I think Americans, I know when I think of Valley Forge, I think of cold, you know, winter weather, you know, the soldiers out in the snow with bleeding feet and freezing to death. But if you read Patricia Brady's book, it was a little bit different than you think. And so my wife is, she found this very fascinating. So we're going to start talking about this. But how many of you out there really know that Martha Washington spent the winters at Valley Forge with George Washington? So I'm going to let you take over now, dear. So I've taken half the program. Sorry.
That's okay. This is your program. So, yes, I found it very interesting because, like you say, we had, all of us growing up in America, we've had the United States history, and, you know, it's always the pictures of the which is really true. It was really true that the soldiers didn't have shoes. I mean, they were really under. They didn't have the provisions they should have had. But I didn't realize that wives went and helped the officers, at least. And so I just wanted to read a couple things here. It just shows a little bit about what other people thought of her, of Martha Washington. You know, we know that Lafayette came and helped with the Revolutionary War. He was actually really became a good friend of George Washington. But he wrote, this is something he wrote.
He was French, correct?
He was French, yes. Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, Lafayette was from France, yes.
You would know that because you speak French.
Well, I thought most people knew that. Anyway, yeah. Well, Lafayette wrote
sorry,
to it.
Sorry, I didn't know that. Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
I guess I did know that. Excuse me.
So, anyway, Lafayette wrote to his adoring wife, who probably would have swooned with delight at an invitation to join her husband. Several general officers have brought their wives to camp, and I'm very envious, not of their wives, who are rather dull, but of the pleasure they have in being able to see them. General Washington has also just decided to send for his wife, a modest and respectable person who loves her husband madly. So, she did go. She arrived in Valley Forge in February 1778, and it was the third year that she joined her husband to camp. And the American soldiers actually came to look for her arrival because it meant that the fighting was definitely over for the year. That was what was interesting, is they would fight in the spring and summer, and maybe a little bit into the fall, and then they stopped, you know, during the winter.
Maybe that's why it took 8 years.
Right. Yes. Right. So anyway, she came, and it says here, Lady Washington was cheered by the troops when she made her annual appearance. Not the least excited of them was George Washington, who fretted for days before her arrival. Valley Forge indelibly created the image of the nurturing commander's wife, who did all she could to relieve the soldiers' needs. She became a mother figure, marching Washington's patriarchal role, a pleasant, kind woman who visited the hospital and showed motherly care for the soldiers sick and well. So there was a lot of deprivation, and there were bloody footprints left in the snow. But she did help, you know, by being there. She helped George, and she helped other soldiers, and she actually did a lot of it sounds less like entertaining, but it was, she actually would have dinners every night, and the officers would come to whatever kind of place they were staying in, maybe somebody's cabin or house or something like that, and she would always manage to make it an enjoyable time. So they did a lot of those things in the winter, which was interesting.
I guess I think that obviously, you know, I have a picture of Valley Forge just from paintings. You know, I think there must have been cabins there, because surely they wouldn't have just had her go out and camp.
Right.
Camp around a campfire.
Right. They had some kind of a house for them, and then for George and his wife. But they did actually build some wooden barracks. It says right here the men were housed in the wooden barracks they had built, their rags and tatters a joke as they huddled around roaring fires. At least there was plenty of wood in the valley and ample water. So and they also got food from neighboring says from neighboring farms as well. But it was still difficult. But Martha, you know, was able to spend time with George, even though it was a difficult situation. He tried to make it as comfortable for her as possible, and she was trying to make it comfortable for him too. So right. they would try to help each other that way.
After that, we then moved into a long series on Michael Corder's book, Hero, The Life and Legend of Lawrence of Arabia. Now, it was Mr. Gerald Fleury who asked me to cover this book on the radio to help explain to listeners why the Middle East is the way it is today. Now, this was definitely a challenging book to discuss. I had to study a lot of background history to understand it well enough to cover it over the radio. But personally, I learned that one cannot truly understand the Middle East of today without knowing T.E. Lawrence's life and his history. And he really did have a strong influence on the way the Middle East is organized today. Now, two of the two most helpful programs in this series were on the Balfour Declaration. Brent Nottigall, host of Watch Jerusalem, graciously devoted his time for two programs on this most misunderstood event of the Middle East. And so here's that clip. I do feel it's very important that we talk about the Balfour Declaration. Now, Corder doesn't give us a lot on that in the book. He does talk about it somewhat. And since we're discussing the events in 1917, I thought this would be a great time to do it. Now, the Balfour Declaration itself is very short, but the document has a history of conflict. And I just want to read it to you just to show you how short it is, and then we'll begin to open up our discussion on it. This is from the Foreign Office, November 2nd, 1917. And it begins, "Dear Lord Rothschild, I have much pleasure in conveying to you, on behalf of His Majesty's government, the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the Cabinet. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. I should be grateful if you would bring this declaration to the knowledge of the Zionist Federation. Yours, Arthur James Balfour." And of course, he was the British Foreign Secretary at the time. Now, to help me discuss this important document, I do have with me in the studio today Mr. Brent Nottigall, who is host of KPCG's Watch Jerusalem radio program. So Brent is here in the States with his wife and children. They're visiting our headquarters campus here in Edmond. And so he's coming to us from his residence in Jerusalem. So welcome, Brent.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on your show.
Oh, well, this is awesome. We need this cross-fertilization. Well, thanks for taking the time to help me discuss this important document. Now, I have been reading a book on the subject outside of Korda's book, and that book is titled The Balfour Declaration, The Origins of the Arab-Israeli Conflict, and it's by Jonathan Schneer. Now, I think it's a fascinating book. I do highly recommend it to all of you JBL listeners out there. It gives you much more detail than Korda's book does on the same subjects. But I'm not so sure I like the title. And I know that that Brent has written articles on the Balfour Declaration. Being involved in Jerusalem the way he is, he's helped us on our archaeological projects. He is our man on the street in Jerusalem for the Trumpet and the trumpet.com, and so he's deeply involved in all the events there. So I would just like to read to you that even another quote from this book. I know on a previous program we also, one of our panel members said that the Balfour Declaration was not a good document or wasn't a, and after reading this book, I don't necessarily agree with that. And also my discussions with Brent, I don't agree with that. So we want to make sure we clear some of that up today. But here's what actually Schneer does say in his opening to the book. And I think it's a good quote. And we're going to get Brent to weigh in on this quote as well. But here's what he says. This is page 14 of the new book I'm reading. It's called The Balfour Declaration. It says, "The Balfour Declaration was not, in and of itself, the source of trouble in a land that previously had been more or less at peace. But nor was it a mere signpost on a road heading inadvertently toward a cliff. No one can say what the course of events in Palestine might have been without it. What did come about was the product of forces and factors entirely unforeseen." So I think that paragraph does pretty much sum up what we are dealing with when we talk about the Balfour Declaration. But I'd just like to know what you think, Brent. How do you weigh in on that quote?
I think it's pretty good in that it shows that the original intent of the Balfour Declaration wasn't to impact the Arabs at all. They would have been respected in many ways. And even as we would probably get to, the chief architects of the Balfour Declaration, the Jewish ones, and in accordance with some of the Arab leaders at the time, right when it was signed and shortly thereafter in the First World War, were grateful for each other's presence in the land. And there was not Arab rejectionism of the Balfour Declaration itself. Now, it has been painted, let's say, ever since probably like 1922, like shortly thereafter, from that point forward, going through even when Israel became a state and the different wars, and even the Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, he labels Balfour as the original sin that led, that brought the Jews to Israel, to this land of Palestine that used to be theirs. And I think we have had this great historical revisionism on Balfour, especially over the past 50 years, and especially in maybe the past 3 years, 2 years, as we came to the centenary 2 years ago. It was talked about all the time. And all the Arab leaders were discussing with Britain, please renounce Balfour, renounce it. You know, how can you even accept that your government did such a thing? And yet the British government did come on strong and say they were proud of it still. But you really have to go back to 1916-17 and see how, as he even brings out in that quote, that this was the product of forces and factors entirely unforeseen, this agreement. There was, I believe, God's hand behind this agreement and the other factors that led to its being. We see a brief moment of time when such a declaration could be given by the power of the land, being the British Empire, power of the world at the time, bestowing upon the Jews a homeland that they hadn't, or a potential homeland upon them that they hadn't received for 2,000 years. And so it's a pretty majestic moment.
Yeah, I think one of the things that you brought out just here in the last few minutes is the revisionist history. And I know that I've thought a lot about this, of course. You know, I was raised Roman Catholic. I always call it Roman Irish Catholic. And there is a good measure of anti-Semitism, you know, in the Catholic Church. We just have to be honest about that. And I know when you ever heard the word Zionism, it could like bring up the hackles on the back of your neck, you know, like, wow, this is really bad stuff. But since I've, kind of been awakened to real history, there's a lot of history behind this that has just been completely forgotten. And certainly, you know, I think I can also honestly say that, you know, the Catholics have, you know, everyone is sincere in their beliefs. I don't want to criticize anybody for their beliefs, but they're not Bible readers. And, you know, Bible history says this is the Jewish homeland. I mean, where Jerusalem is, and of course, it was called Judea at one time, not just Palestine. I mean, those are kind of modern interventions by the pro-Arab League or by the pro-Arabic intellectuals that are out there. And so I think it's good that you bring out some of this pro-Zionist history, you know, how it all got started. And I think maybe I can, because of Korda's book, and of course I've had the chance to read this Balfour Declaration, is that I know from reading both, in the very beginning, the Arabic peoples were in favor of the Jews, you know, having a homeland and being in that area. In fact, there were Jews already living in the area before World War I.
Right. I mean, you had the big Jewish migrations to this land in the early 19th century before World War I, in response to a lot of what was happening in Russia. If Jews could get out of what was happening in East or Western Russia, basically, if people remember Fiddler on the Roof.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, that time period is right when this seed of Zionism was born. And this was an idea that the Jews have always lived in this area, even after the Romans expelled them in 70 AD.
Right.
There were plenty of Jews that lived in history through the Byzantine Empire and the Crusaders there, and even through the Ottoman period. There were always Jews in Jerusalem.
Right.
And so their historic attachment to the land is not just found in the Bible, but it's found in the history of the last 2,000 years. And really, there was a problem before World War II relating to Jewish assimilation inside Europe. And there were people that thought that it couldn't be done and that they needed to go somewhere else and have their own state. There were Jews that said that we've just been making headway in the early 1900s in France and Britain, and we are assimilating, and we've got high positions and high office, and there's Jews in the parliaments, and so it's great. So let's not distract everybody with this idea that we need our own homeland. And so you did have varying degrees of support amongst the Jewish community for this originally. But we tend to think of the birth of Israel as being purely the result of the Holocaust. And the Nazis were bad to the Jews, and they killed 6 million of them. And so finally, let's just give them a place of their own so that they can escape that and have somewhere to go. And so many of the Arab leaders today, I'm not saying it was that way, it definitely wasn't, want to portray the Jewish statehood as being Western guilt or trying to rectify Nazi guilt, let's put it that way, for what they did to the Jews. So let's give them a land. And they're like, well, what are they doing coming to our spot? This is our patch of the earth. Why not send them elsewhere? And they forget that 40 years previous to that, you already had mass Jewish migration to this area.
Right.
And you had it being supported by the main power of the land, of the earth, the British Empire.
Yeah, what few people realize is that it was the Tsar in Russia that said, you know, we're going to make a third of the Jews living in Russia. They're going to have to become, you know, Russian Orthodox. You know, a third of them, we're going to get rid of them. We're going to put them out of the country. And the other third are going to starve to death. I mean, that was the decision that was made before World War II.
Right, right. And so really, this is a declaration that really does honor the Jews with what many would see as their historical right to come back to a land that at the time the British were winning, as we'll get to, were going to overcome and eventually have control over this territory to dictate, rightly or wrongly, they had the power to do so as being victorious and ousting the Ottomans that didn't have a right necessarily to this land either.
Right.
And so you really have to say, if we're going to talk about, you know, whether it's going to be the Arabs or the Jews. And that's why I don't really like the subtitle for that book, Origins of the Arab-Israeli Conflict, because it really did take place after Balfour. People were on board with Balfour. Right. I would say that it was very rare that you had all these aligning factors that led to the Balfour Declaration, which the Jews were looking for basically a foreign power to give a statement like this, that they favored a Jewish homeland in the area of Palestine for the Jews. They were looking for somebody to do it, and eventually they settled on the British Empire as being the greatest. They put all their eggs in that basket. This was even prior to World War I and the fact that the Brits were starting to take this territory. Before they even knew that, they recognized that it was going to be Britain that would be in the position to say that this is a good idea.
Now, for all of you regular listeners out there, you know that after the podcast on Lawrence, we moved into the Krauthammer series, and I trust you have enjoyed this short look into the past 200 episodes. I really do look forward to producing the next 100 programs. Well, that's all the time we have for today's program. Next time, I will discuss a new Charles Krauthammer essay. And remember, we are just about weeks away from completing this series on his book, Things That Matter. Now, there's still a few more weeks to come, and even if you're just catching into the series now, it's still a book worth having. And you can buy this book at Amazon.com. You can find a used copy of the book at abebooks.com. And, of course, you can also check your local library. Please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at jbliterature1. And you can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And I will be beefing that page on Facebook up over the summer months. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.